This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 425 for June 22nd of 2018, Creating the Atomic Car Seat. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Dr. Data, I mean Gary Vasilash, you're here.
How you doing, John?
I'm doing great.
I was thinking we should have had the show at Stonehenge today since it's the summer solstice. I don't think the droids had cars, though, but I'm just guessing.
Not that we know of yet.
Not that we know of.
But they had some mechanisms, right? Flying saucers to lift the big stones?
Possibly.
They had to do it somehow.
Yeah, that's right.
And that third voice you just heard is Sam Abulsamid from Navigant Research. Great having you on the show here, Sam.
Glad to be back again, guys.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Good.
Thank you.
But our special guest for today is Chuck Cushy. He's the founder, the president, and the chief technology officer of a company called Prometheant. And Chuck, great having you on the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yeah. I mean, this is a startup, essentially, that you've got, right? And it's at least your second startup.
Yes, third, actually.
Uh-huh.
Maybe fourth.
Uh-oh.
Serial entrepreneur.
Serial entrepreneur, isn't that the term?
Yes.
But this time, you've got a product out called Thermavance.
Yes.
And it uses graphene.
Yeah, we use solid-state heat pumping, a thermoelectric device, and we marry that with graphene. So we have a mechanism to cause heat to be moved, and then we use the graphene to disperse that heat, or I'm going to use the term very poorly, but disperse the cooling as well in a seating application or garments or whatever.
So tell us what graphene is. I mean, it's a rather bizarre material.
Yes, graphene is an allotrope of carbon, so it is just carbon, carbon atoms, and it's been with us basically forever, but it was really discovered in the early 2000s by a group in England. And so it is fairly new material, and what it is one atomic layer thickness of carbon. And when you do that with carbon and also some other structures as well, they can be very electrically and thermally conductive. And so we use the benefit of that material with a thermoelectric device, a solid-state heat pump, to generate heat and cooling and be able to disperse that in something that's very thin, extremely thin and lightweight and strong.
You said a group of British researchers sort of discovered it, but you also said it's been around a long time.
Well, because it's a part of, let's say, graphite, but it just was not known in that structure, that atomic level, because we just, in latter years, we've been able to see at those levels and understand those levels.
Is it a matter of first realizing that it existed in that sort of single atomic layer structure, as opposed to a three-dimensional structure like a diamond?
Correct. And also what also aided it is the ability to pull those layers apart and actually study it as a single layer.
This is a real fun fact about how they did that. They used cellophane tape. So yes. they had a surface of graphite, and they put sticky tape on it. These two researchers at the university.
To pull the layers apart?
University of Manchester. So when you lift it up, you get a layer, and then they kept subdividing that, but it just all came down to scotch tape.
It did.
Is that single layer structure the key to its unique properties? Because I don't think regular graphite, as we think of it, doesn't really have the same properties.
That is correct. It is that single layer that gives it its properties, and also its length over area ratio is very different than graphite. In other words, it might be only one atomic layer thick, but it is many microns long or wide. And when you have that kind of structure, you have what are called edge effects that allow electrons or phonons, which is heat, to move very efficiently.
There's been a lot of excitement about this material, but I haven't heard much of it being used in commercial products. Is that starting to change?
It is starting to change. It is starting to change. And you will start to, it is starting to be used in fluids for cooling, let's say, machining operations in oils to aid in the cooling of engines and motors just by using the microflakes. You know, suspended in fluids.
Because of its heat transfer properties?
Exactly, because of the heat transfer properties. And also in plastics to improve both strength but also heat transfer again, because that's a major mode of failure in plastics. And if you can move the heat away from a hot area, then that's a big benefit. Plus, it gives extra strength. And we're pretty early in on the moving heat just using the graphene itself. We use pure graphene. We don't mix it with anything.
So where do you get it?
Well, that we have worked with a few different suppliers in the world and over the last 3.5 years to develop the material so it's in a format that we can use. But it can be sourced in North America and elsewhere.
Is it like a fabric when you get it, or?
It can be, yes. It's like in a sheet. It's in a sheet form, but we specify how many layers of graphene we want, because one layer of graphene, even though it's extremely thermally conductive, it's only an atomic layer thick, so you still can't move that much heat. So you have to have a certain number of layers to give you the properties that we want to use, you know, to move
like
a certain amount of heat.
A single layer might also have some durability issues, especially
indeed,
the way you're using it.
Seems like a single layer would be invisible.
It is invisible, totally clear.
So what are you doing with the graphene?
Well, what we do is, let's look at let's say, in automotive seating. What we do is we place a layer of graphene, actually in strips, underneath the seat cover, whether it be leather or vinyl or cloth or whatever. And then we use the thermoelectric device, a solid-state device, to pump heat out of that graphene. Let's say we want to cool someone. Well, they are in direct contact with that cooling source at that point. We're not cooling air, which has a very low specific heat. We are actually cooling the human body directly, and it's very effective to do it that way. Just think of, let's say you have a tea kettle on the stove and it's very hot, and you can put your hand next to it and you can feel that it's hot, but when you touch it, that direct conductive heat transfer is a whole different animal. And so you can transfer much more energy conductively than you can, let's say, through air.
So it's less energy needed to do this?
Much less energy needed.
So this is heating and cooling, or just cooling?
Heating and cooling with the same device.
So right now, if we have a car with heated and cooled seats, they have little fans for the cooling, and then they have coils for the heating? Is that basically how
it works? There are different methodologies used today. One is, yes, you can have a heat mat, for the heating, and then you can ventilate, through holes, perforations using a fan, perforations in the leather, say. And you can actually also have a solid-state heat pump that cools air and puts it through perforations. And we take, as I mentioned, a little different approach. We take the graphene and put it directly under the seat cover such that, we just pump heat directly out of the individual. Or we can heat with it. It heats or cools.
All right. When you say pump heat out of the individual, okay,
yes.
So I'm sitting in a seat right now.
Yes.
And if this were set up here, it would draw heat out of me? Or
it would
just be my natural?
No, it would draw heat out of you. That's why it is so effective.
And that's by using the thermoelectric material, right?
Well, it's the graphene is what's underneath the leather, let's say.
Right.
And so, yes, but it's a solid-state device that pumps the heat out of the graphene, first of all. And then the graphene is cold, and you're sitting on, just a layer or two separates you from that graphene. So we actually just, and I use the term pump. I could use other words, but, generally that's what's used. you know, it pumps the heat out of your body. And we can pump about 15 watts with one surface out of your body. And that's a lot, because if you think of the human body as being able to produce about 75 to 150 watts, depending on your level of physical activity, 15 watts is a lot of heat. In other words, we actually can regulate your body temperature quite effectively.
So how do you do the opposite? How do you make me cool?
You just switch the polarity on the thermoelectric device, and it heats the system.
The graphene is effectively acting as a replacement for the coil or the resistive mat, and the heat transfer is transferring through the graphene and then through the seat covering right to your body.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And if you think about in a normal vehicle where, let's say, a cooling system, you know, can be several kilowatts, in other words, several thousands of watts to maintain somebody's body temperature or other people in the vehicle. Compare that to if you're pumping heat directly out of the body or into the body. You know, we can do the same with 100 watts or less. So it's a phenomenal energy savings in a vehicle.
You're using this in seats now, or you're taking this to automakers?
We are taking it to automakers. We've been through quite a bit of testing already with, different companies.
And supplier companies.
Supplier and OEMs.
Can you name who you're working with?
I cannot.
Okay.
I cannot. I will say, because it is public knowledge, that Forcia, the large automotive seat maker, is an investor in our company. So we have worked closely with them for a couple years. And so we're pretty far along as far as being able to work, you know, within the packaging environments of the seating structure.
But do you have a purchase order from an OEM?
No, we don't. Okay. No, we don't. That's all still in development, though we have some other programs that are going into production this year in the golf car industry as well as the motorsports industry. And one of the big benefits also, in other words, you usually can't have the normally type of ventilated or cooled seats in outdoor motorsports at all, because water would get into the perforations. Because we don't require that, you know, it can be a totally sealed surface. And so, therefore, that industry is very quick to pick up the idea.
Would that be what? IndyCar, sports car racing? When you say motorsports, what?
By that, I mean more outdoor type.
Off-road vehicles?
Off-road vehicles, yeah. Things like that, uh-huh. Yes. And on-road vehicles, too, but just a little more outdoor sporty.
Oh, go ahead, John.
Packaging, it sounds like it'd be a whole lot less than what's in seats today.
Well, usually it is. We are easier to package in most cases. There are a few cases that we've run into that it's still difficult. there are so many mechanisms within a seat these days that it's sometimes difficult to find real estate.
Your turn.
The graphene is your heat spreader, and you're using the thermoelectric material to actually transfer the heat in one direction or the other into or out of the graphene.
That's correct.
Is that thermoelectric material significantly different from? And there's been some experiments over the years by various automakers with doing thermoelectric generators to capture electricity from exhaust heat. Is that basically the same kind of thing we're talking about here?
Well, theoretically, yes, it is basically the same kind of thing, but different semiconductor alloys are used for power generation. They are considered high-temperature thermoelectric materials, like a lead antimony, silver tin telluride, or whatever. And we are based in more of the bismuth telluride world, which is, for our temperature range, is very efficient and effective. So conceptually, it's the same. You use the same equations and all of that, but it's...
But it's optimized for a different temperature profile?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Chuck, how'd you get onto this? Did you go, all right, graphene, now we can heat and cool seats real easily, or how'd this come about?
Well, I've been working in the thermoelectric device world for, I hate to say how long, 30 years. And actually growing the semiconductor material. I'm very intimate, you know, with making those kinds of things. And always, you know, over, you know, the past 30 years, you're always trying to do something with that, you know, heating or cooling that you've generated. And oftentimes you have to use metals, you know, aluminum, copper, whatever. I mean, that's the normal way to do it. And I keep up on materials research, and I saw graphene, and I started to scratch my head, but I couldn't find any to work with. But eventually I did, and then just got all the patent stuff lined up and put that together. But right out of the gate, it was good.
Mm-hmm. So what about the reliability of this? I mean, presumably the use case in an automobile, or even more so in this outdoor vehicle, it would
yes.
be very demanding
very
for this
demanding.
Material.
Yeah.
How are you guys proving that out to be reliable?
Well, that's a very good question, because the material, you know, can, it's not brittle, but it can be somewhat brittle if you don't use the right configurations. And again, like I say, we sort of custom order how the graphene is made, and that helps a lot. But to answer your question more directly, it has been tested in the automotive 10,000 knee test, you know, where the 10,000 pushes with the metal knee, and it was successful. It looked a little beat up, but it still operated fine. So,
what about cost compared to the types of systems we're using today?
Competitive.
Okay.
Yeah, competitive. And, as you know, it's not as inexpensive as just heating, because that's just a mat. But once heating and cooling is integrated, we're competitive with that.
And certainly you've got the packaging advantages compared to a conventional system and lower power. So kind of
right.
the net, it sounds like net, it's going to come out way ahead, especially for an electric vehicle.
I believe so, yes. And there are vehicle companies that just don't want the perforations as well, because of, let's say your soft drinks being spilled into them, or whatever the case may be. They just don't want those kinds of electrical issues.
Sam raises a good point. This would sound perfect for EVs with lower draw.
It really is, because, you know, as we all know, in electric vehicles, range is ultimately important. And when you start heating and cooling vehicles, electric vehicles, that downgrades the range quite significantly. You know, there have been papers that have been written, you know, out of Europe and whatnot that talk about 50% range reductions, which is a lot. And so, therefore, that's because some of these electric vehicles have heating and cooling systems that are several kilowatts, you know, up to about 5 kilowatts. That's 5,000 watts. And we can do roughly the same thing per person, as I mentioned before, at about 100 watts. So it's a huge, huge improvement, and can really, and not only that, does it improve range and things like that. You're just much more comfortable, because you and the person next to you can totally control their own comfort level. And so that's also, you know, an important feature. In other words, it's not just range, it is comfort.
Do you see the possibility of being able to use this and not have a heater or an air conditioner in a car?
It is possible. We are so used to having that environment around us conditioned that, yes, you know, thermally we can do it. We know that, because we can pump the heat out of you and keep you cool enough that you say, uncle. even in a hot environment. So yes, you can, but I don't know if the population is ready for that yet.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
There may come a time, but I don't believe so at this point.
And is there, I mean, from the reading that I've done on graphene, it seems like the world capacity isn't that great right now. And it seems to have all kinds of promise for all kinds of different industries, and auto being perhaps only this much of it. So how do you guys get a reliable source of this?
That's a real good question. We do have some reliable sources. And also, too, as part of that pipeline, because of all of this, you know, this, and I won't call it hype because it's real as far as the utilization techniques for the material in electronics and whatnot. The base materials are starting to ramp up, you know, all the way from the graphite mines. In the United States, we don't have an operating graphite mine, if you can believe that, and, you know, to make graphene with. Well, in Canada, that is not the case. And in the U.S., things are starting to improve in that regard as well. Because, you know, once you have that base material flowing, and there's a lot of natural graphite in the world. It's just you have to mine it. It hasn't been commercially very worthwhile to do it. But now that you have another income stream for that, a high-value one, it makes a lot more economic sense. So that side of things, the supply side is improving, mm-hmm. you know, day by day.
Is it economically viable to synthesize graphene from coal?
Well, you can do, you can synthesize. And it is done, and we've used it and tested it and all that, and it's very good material.
I think we certainly have lots of coal.
Well, I think in the long
we're
run...
We're going to have more.
Yeah. In the long run, though, the numbers still look good for natural graphite.
Mm-hmm. We're using fewer pencils, so...
Right.
I mean, it basically is that material.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. Yep.
Hey, we've got a number of questions coming in here, some really good ones, too. Bob Wilson from Huntsville, Alabama says, could you adapt this to the windshield of a car so that you could defog the windshield faster?
Well, you probably could. We probably won't do that because we work with thicker graphene material. In a windshield, you would need a very thin layer of graphene. And once you get that thin, to transmit that amount of heat over a distance of a windshield would be difficult. It's probably better done, you know, electrical resistance at this point.
He also asked, could this be used as a thermocouple to generate significant electricity from waste heat of the engine exhaust?
Yes, it could, theoretically, and I've worked on that a lot in my past as far as waste heat generation from vehicles. The particular alloy we use is not that great for those temperatures. The system itself has to be really designed for those hot and very corrosive environments.
Mm-hmm. But that, that has
theoretically,
been done.
I mean, it has been done.
Porsche did it on the 919 LMP1 car, at least in the early iterations of it. That was one of their energy recovery systems, was a thermoelectric generator. And BMW, I know, has been doing a lot of work with it over the years.
Yeah, so. They have.
Bob also asked, when can he get driving gloves that cool in the summer and heat in the winter? You mentioned apparel.
Well, we are working on apparel. We have an active program right now for jackets and suits. So that is coming. We do have a pretty small unit that heats and cools that we're developing right now for the medical market. So we're not that far off, Bob.
There's another company that just came out with shoes that is using graphene. So.
Uh-huh. Ooh. But that's just for heating, I believe.
Great ski gear, though.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I want ski boots that do that.
Yeah, yeah.
He wants to know, what temperature ranges does this technology work on, or can he get a data sheet?
Well, it's the data sheet. We do have them for the OEMs and for the, let's say, the seat folks that we're working with. I will say it's very specific to the application, what the data sheet looks like. Mm-hmm. And so it's nothing that we're public with yet.
Gotcha. Okay. Arthur Cravioto says, hey, guys, how long do you think it would take for graphene to become a viable battery for EVs or used in batteries, I guess?
It's already being used. There's already work being done in graphene for the anode and cathode materials to allow for faster charging.
Mm-hmm. Austin Holzman asked, when will we see mass production of graphene? Is it easy to produce? But I think you've already touched on that.
Yeah, it is ramping up, even in North America, to a very large scale. In other words, before, when it was just tons being made, it's tons of tons now. It's really improving quickly.
Is it all CVD?
No, actually, most of it is not.
Chemical vapor deposition. Oh.
Actually, most of it is not, as far as the bulk process.
They use a lot of Scotch tape?
No. No. There are
very
different processes.
There's
a chemical process that blows the platelets apart, and there's also some mechanical processes that they use to do that.
What kind of timeline do you foresee potentially having this seat heating and cooling system in production? Like, are we talking early 2020s, mid-20s?
Well, we are going into production this year for the sport vehicle market and the golf car market. And the sport vehicle market is not tiny. Mm-hmm. It doesn't equal automotive size, but it is not tiny either. And we are going into production.
Okay. It's like when we had the Mahindra Rockstar.
I was just thinking that. Doc Wolf wrote in to mention, he says, if graphene has such a high tensile strength, it could be great for crash structures in cars.
It can be. If it's put in combination with other materials, it can be, much like a carbon fiber.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's see. Is there anything else? I think we've got to all the different questions that have come in so far. But it's probably a good point to wrap up this segment. And Chuck Cushy, thanks so much for coming in. Very interesting
stuff. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, no.
It's been fun.
I mean, you explain it so well, I think I might even understand it.
I need a set of those seats for my Miata so I can drive it year-round.
Yeah, right. With the top down, right? Yeah, real good. Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break right now. We got more to talk about, but we'll be back in just a moment.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back, and this is part of the show for Dr. Data.
Indeed it is. So this is a self-explanatory one. So, Katie, could you please bring the first image up? Ooh, we got new graphics down there.
Yeah, look at that.
There we go. Okay, see, these are not cumulative World Cup scores. See, I wanted to make this topical. You know, we've got the World Cup going on, and we've got Canada, Russia, USA are all competing, but it's not the cumulative scores from those soccer games. So Canada 170, Russia 80, USA 35. What could those numbers represent?
Hmm.
The total number of World Cup games those countries have played over the history of the World Cup?
No way.
It could be, but this has to do with the auto industry, and I'm glad to see that it's disguised. So, John, you can't tell what that is. I know what it is, and I can't tell what it is.
Yeah. No, the fuzzy background doesn't give anything away whatsoever. So this is automotive.
This relates to the auto industry.
170 for Canada, 80 for Russia, 35 for the USA.
The amount of steel and aluminum brought into the U.S. market from those countries?
That's a good one. That's a very good one. I like that. But you're wrong.
I have no clue.
And the answer is proven oil reserves by billions of barrels. So I had to look this up. And it's remarkable. So we have 35 billion barrels of oil in reserve in the United States. I mean, that's basically what they've discovered that exists. Guess how many billions of barrels of oil a year we use?
I don't know.
5?
7.26 were used in 2017. So our oil reserves are just a few years. It's amazing to me.
Well, yeah, but that's a number that's constantly changing.
Yeah, I mean that's been changing forever.
But it's not going to change hugely. So basically, you have five years. This is the Energy Information Agency. These guys have calculated all that stuff.
This is the proven barrels,
right?
So there's still probably a lot more out there that they haven't verified yet.
Possibly.
Well, I know there's, I don't know why, but there's a difference between oil shale and shale oil. And what we've been using up to now is shale oil. But oil shale, they're looking at cracking using microwaves. And, you know, Canada, you showed, had 170 billion barrels. I believe that
Saudi... We ought to be friendlier to them,
I think. Yeah, we should be friendlier to them. They're good neighbors.
Our sands, though.
Right. But I was going to say Saudi Arabia has something like 280 billion barrels, but there is a this oil shale deposit under, like, Colorado and I think it might be Idaho and Nebraska or somewhere out there. That's like 500 billion barrels if they can open it up.
If you can open it up.
And that's where I'm getting at, is proven reserves is what we know exactly right now.
Exists.
This afternoon exists, right.
I believe in existence. I'm not an existentialist like you, John. I just the here and now, that matters the most.
And I just read today, as a matter of fact, that the U.S. is now the largest oil producer in the world. We've just gone past Russia. We're producing, I want to say it's something just north of 10 million barrels a day. Mm-hmm. And this oil expert was saying it's going to go to 15 million barrels in the next 5 years. And then we're going to run out real fast.
And I was also surprised.
Your numbers.
I was also surprised to look at, okay, so a barrel of oil is 42 gallons.
Right.
Okay, so how much gasoline do you get out of that?
I want to say you get around 25 gallons.
I think it's actually a little less than that. I think it's closer to about 15.
Right down the middle, 20.
Okay.
So you get 20 gallons of gasoline and 11 gallons of diesel out of a barrel of oil.
And a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, and the rest of it's all plastic stuff and tar and pothole filler. And we could use more of that, by the way.
We absolutely could.
Ship it to Domino's and they'll take care of the roads for us. But so I thought that was very interesting to see how much the proven oil reserves exist. So you were just in South Carolina, North
Charleston,
Carolina?
Charleston, South Carolina. Volvo just opened a new plant there. They're going to build the S60 to begin with.
That's a sedan.
And then they're going to build the next generation XC90 there. In a
SUV.
SUV in another year or two or something like that. And it's pretty interesting. I mean, their timing couldn't be better with Trump talking about all these tariffs and everything like that. But the real news that I got out of it, though, had nothing to do with the plant or the car or anything like that. I got to do interviews with the CEO of Volvo Cars. Håkan Samuelsson, exactly right. And their chief technology officer, head of R&D, a guy named Henrik Green. And the head of Polestar, who had been the head of design, and now he's the head of Polestar, which, you know, had started off as sort of a performance brand, sort of Volvo's AMG or M, but now is going to blossom into its own electric car company. And they said starting at the end of next year, they're coming out with a model that's going to go head-to-head with the Tesla Model 3. And Håkan Samuelsson, the CEO, promised it will be profitable from day one.
So that's not the Polestar 1 that you're talking about, right?
No.
That's a different model.
The Polestar 1 is it's a PHEV, very high performance, 400 horsepower plus, 400 foot-pounds plus, about a $155,000 price tag. They're going to make fewer than 1,000 of them, and it's going to be carbon fiber. And we got a picture of it up right now. It's a coupe. Great-looking design, excellent-looking. But they're going to do this PHEV, and that's it. Everything from then on is going to be battery electric. But I had not heard any...
The Polestar brand, you mean?
Under the Polestar brand.
Right.
And now they're going to make it very confusing. So they're keeping the Polestar performance stuff. So you can get an S60 Polestar-engineered... Or Polestar, you know, it's like...
Well, it's the same as all the European premium brands. I mean, you've got BMW M, and then you've got the M Sport packages, and you've got AMG Sport packages on standard Mercedes models.
But again, they're creating this whole new brand, essentially its own company called Polestar, that's going to be only battery electrics, once they after they launch this PHEV?
Well, when Polestar as Polestar started out as a Swedish company, basically what it was doing is it was doing software modifications that you would download to your engine control module and you would make your Volvo go faster.
Okay. Right.
And so basically I'm wondering whether going forward that you have the Polestar company that is producing these EVs, and then they also have their guys who are writing code, and this code then will go into the Volvo sedans and Volvo crossovers and Volvo station wagons, and it'll go faster because they have that code that's going to make
the
modification.
And you're right. It'll be software, but it'll be, you know, tire suspension,
right.
You know, all kinds of sport trim and that kind of stuff,
right.
too, right? But it's going to be a little bit confusing.
So that's interesting. $1.1 billion investment in making a factory in the United States to build cars.
Yeah.
Sort of unthinkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's what everyone's asking. Why are you doing a car? And I think it's just got to do with their product cadence.
Because all of Volvo's products right now and going forward are based off of two platform architectures. You've got the SPA, the scalable product architecture, which is under the 60 and 90 series vehicles, so the S60, V60, XC60, and the 90s. And then the smaller architecture, I forget what the name is, but
isn't
that's
it like CPA.
I think so. Yeah. So that's what that's what they're using for the 40 series. Yeah. So the XC40 is the first one. There'll be some couple of cars off of that, and then also the Lincoln Co. cars that that they're building are also on that same platform.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that they said for this new the S60 will be offered through Care by Volvo, and I was reading a story on Engadget this week that apparently the Care by Volvo isn't working out so well in terms of people who have signed up for this program. And I know when they were talking about it, or we talked about it on the show, and you were somewhat skeptical and critical of what they're talking about with that, John.
Well, what you're talking about is subscription services.
Right.
And to me, they charge a nice premium for that. This is not a gift to the consumer. Mm-hmm. You know, some people might find it convenient because it is convenient. It includes all your insurance, all your maintenance. All you have to do is put gas in the car is what it comes down to. But I hadn't heard that they didn't talk about that. They still talk glowingly of Care by Volvo.
Oh, yeah, apparently there's an issue because they're offering so much and they're, you know, in insurance and things like that wrapped into it. And I guess that each state has different laws that
there's a lot of little logistical issues to put all that together, especially when you do it on a nationwide basis like that. That's why most of the experiments we've seen with subscriptions up until now have been pilots in specific regions. Like Cadillac launched Book a couple of years ago in New York, and I think they've spread to Miami now. But it's in a very specific region where, you know, it's a lot easier to manage all those moving pieces of that program, the insurance and maintenance and everything else.
Yeah, I was looking. So for the S60, the one that you saw yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, so there's one version that you can buy, the T6 all-wheel drive momentum, and you can buy it for $40,300. Or you can get this subscription service for $775 a month. Or you can get the higher-end R-Design trim, which costs $45,400, and that costs you $850 a month. So as you said, this is...
Not a gift to the consumer.
You're paying for the convenience of not having to go shop for insurance, and you know also the flexibility of, I think it's a 2-year term, right? So every 2 years you can just swap your car for a new Volvo product and continue paying at whatever the new monthly rate is for whichever product you choose. So there's less in terms of paperwork that you have to deal with and all the other bits and pieces that go around with car ownership.
So what happens? It's
essentially a different variation of leasing.
Yeah, and what happens after 2 years to that car?
I asked them about that, and they will not talk about it. But I said, you got to be thinking about doing a subscription service at a lower cost for that now 2-year-old car. And they said, well, you're thinking in the right direction. I mean, so I believe that's certainly
an option. You could also, refurbish them, put them on the market as a CPO, certified pre-owned, which is also another option. They could also do what GM has done with Maven, the cars that they've put into the Maven car sharing programs and the rental fleets are actually generally not new vehicles. They're usually off-lease vehicles that have come back. They refurb them and they put them into these car sharing programs. So they're still relatively new. They're still in good condition. So Volvo could do something like that, if they got involved with...
But they're not going to. And I'm glad you raised that point because I asked them about that. And they said, car sharing, ride sharing, you have to get a given density of mm-hmm. vehicles to achieve it. And they said, that's not for Volvo.
Right.
But what they also did say, though, is in 2021, they're going to have a level 4 car available for highway driving, where literally you don't have to pay any attention at all. And I thought that was a rather interesting statement. That's, just a couple of years away, they're claiming they're going to have that.
And this will be available like in Gothenburg or?
They didn't specify. All they said is that they are it's also going to depend on regulations and where is it allowed to be sold.
It'll be geofenced around the parking lot.
Well, it'll absolutely have to be geofenced, much like what GM does with Super Cruise.
It'll be exactly like Super Cruise, except instead of a level 2, it's going to be a level 4.
Yeah, so it'll be eyes off, hands off, brain off.
Exactly.
Yeah, whereas Super Cruise is just hands off. But it's still eyes on, brain on.
Correct. Exactly right.
So something happened this week that I never expected that I would read about. The CEO of Audi was taken to prison.
Yeah. Wow. Well, look.
He probably won't be the last.
He will not. Excuse me. But, no, I've been saying for some time now, shame on the German legal system that up to this point, it's only been the American legal system that's done anything to Volkswagen and its cheating. Poor Oliver Schmidt is in jail here, and nobody in Germany until right now has happened. And now I'm starting to realize, okay, the wheels of German justice turn a little bit slower than the American one. But I believe this arrest of Rupert Stadler is only the tip of the iceberg, and I think a bunch of them are going to jail.
From what we've been hearing, it sounds like Martin Winterkorn is probably on their target list and a whole bunch of other executives that have left the upper ranks over the last couple of years and probably some that are still in the upper ranks within the Volkswagen group.
Mm-hmm. But that's just got to be so tough for the people who work for Volkswagen Group that they probably thought that this was behind them. They paid these billions of dollars in fees and fines and are building out the infrastructure for electrical charging in California and on and on and on. And then suddenly, bang.
But the reason they arrested him, which is very interesting, is he was tampering with one of their witnesses, one of his employees. He was trying to stonewall the guy, get him away from all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's when the prosecutors went, oh, wait a minute, yank this guy right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see it. Not that I'm happy about it, but I'm glad to see that, finally the German justice system is starting to crack the whip.
So in better Audi news this week, Audi and Hyundai have announced that they are going to collaborate on the development of fuel cell technology. What's your take on that, Sam? You cover this stuff.
Yeah, I think, Hyundai has definitely been among the leaders in development of fuel cells over the last, certainly in the last 7 or 8 years, right up there with Honda, Toyota, GM. They are continuing to push forward aggressively with that technology. They launched the Nexo, a dedicated fuel cell crossover that they debuted at CES this year. And they've launched it in South Korea, and it'll be coming to the North American market.
And doesn't that have some autonomy, too, that they're working with Aurora?
They're using it as their platform for development of autonomous driving. It's not in production yet on the cars they're selling in Korea right now. Audi has shown some interest in the last few years in fuel cells as well. They did a concept a couple of years ago with a plug-in hybrid fuel cell architecture, similar to what Ford did a decade ago with the Ford Edge, I forget the branding, but they had a concept Ford Edge with a plug-in hybrid fuel cell system where the fuel cell was a smaller fuel cell stack that could operate at steady state, and then they had a plug-in hybrid battery system. Audi did an A7 a couple of years ago that had the same type of architecture in there. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that, you know, they're looking at what Hyundai is doing and say, hey, you know, there's some stuff we can adapt there, you know, to as an alternative, especially for some of the larger vehicles that Audi does. That's really where fuel cells seem like they have the most potential, is in larger vehicles, SUVs and crossovers and some of the larger cars.
Mm-hmm. So, John, we've driven the Insight or the Clarity
fuel cell
vehicle, and so what do you think? Is this move by Audi and Hyundai a drop in the bucket, or is it going to add some volume to that bucket?
Well, we'll see, because it's just in the last week or two that Ford and Daimler disbanded their joint venture to develop fuel cells. And I sort of took that as them thinking, we got other things to do besides do fuel cells right now. But as I've said before, every R&D VP I've talked to in this business believes that fuel cells are the future, that hydrogen is really the way to go. And, you know, so now we've got a full-blown battle on our hand. Is it going to be batteries or is it going to be fuel cells? I know they'll be used in combination, but what will be the predominant one to win out?
Well, it was sort of interesting.
And as you mentioned, Sam, that you know, you've got General Motors and Honda have formed a joint venture company to manufacture fuel cells, not to, you know, fool around in the lab with them. I mean, to actually make these things. And they're talking about, what, 2022?
2020. They're supposed to launch production at the Brownstown plant.
Right. It's just like, so you've got these forces that are now seriously putting some money into this.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting applications for fuel cells besides the larger vehicles I mentioned. You know, you got Nikola Motors that is moving very aggressively, and getting some pretty big orders for their
for a larger vehicle.
Yeah, for their long haul semis
truck. Yeah.
And they're working with Bosch, you know, major supplier, and not only developing the propulsion system, but also developing an infrastructure to support those long-haul trucks, doing localized production of hydrogen instead of trucking in or piping in hydrogen to fueling stations, because these trucks are going to be running cross-country very long distances. It's not really practical to truck it in, but they're going to be producing hydrogen at stations along major routes, trucking routes, doing electrolysis using renewable energy and a water source to produce the hydrogen for the trucks at those stations. And then another potential long-term application is automated mobility services. You know, where, for these vehicles, these automated mobility vehicles, you want to have them in and out. You want to maximize your uptime. You don't want them sitting around plugged in for hours on end every day. And if you have a fleet of vehicles that's operating in a geofenced area, you don't actually need that many stations to service a fleet. They can be, they can come in, get refilled with hydrogen, be back on the road in just a few minutes.
Yeah, hydrogen refueling is pretty much like gasoline, as we experienced at that Shell station
in
Southern California, where we were. So there was another Volkswagen Group announcement this week that Volkswagen and Ford signed a memorandum of understanding that they would begin to work together, and it seemed But they emphasized there would be no equity at all involved in this deal.
It's just some product development partnership on commercial vehicles.
What do you think, John?
Well, look, everybody's got to spend billions on autonomy. They've got to spend billions on electrification. And all of a sudden, you run out of billions. So you still got to keep your old business going. Yeah, you're talking real money. But you got to keep your other business going. So what do? If you can find a partner and cut the cost in half, why not? But the problem with collaborations like that is no one's really in charge. It's generally a 50-50. You got to come to some agreement. And, you know, GM and Ford have worked together on transmissions. The feedback I get is they're not really all that happy with the result. I mean, yeah, they saved some costs, but they really didn't come anywhere near achieving the synergies they thought that they would get, is the feedback I've gotten. But so it'll be interesting to see what VW and Ford can do.
All right. So is it conceivable that, let's say, 10 years from now, these companies would be consolidated.
Very possible. I mean, there's too many car companies in the world. There's too many brands. There's too many models. And
VW has too many brands.
You can argue that, even though it's still quite a profitable company. But and when you look at all the companies coming out of China, now come all kinds of startups, not just in China, even here, with all this electric vehicle and mobility services and the like. I think we're definitely going to see consolidation.
Absolutely. Whether Ford and VW end up being the ones that pair off with each other remains to be seen. But, there will definitely become a lot of combinations going forward.
Mm-hmm.
As John said, startup mainstream manufacturers like NIO and Byton that are based in China but also have operations here in the U.S. And Faraday, apparently has managed to actually really secure some real funding. They've wrested control largely away from their founder. And then you've got companies like Zoox that are really focused on the automated mobility service market. They're building their own vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of players that are going to be in this space.
So, John, you're talking about billions of dollars. So Alex Partners came out with a study this week, and they find that by 2023, $255 billion will be spent in R&D and capital expenditures on electric vehicles, and there is an additional $61 billion being spent on the development of autonomous vehicles. So that's some very serious real money.
It is, and what they're talking about is we're headed for a disaster here, or maybe I should say those are my words.
John Hofnecker calls it a pileup of epic proportions.
Yeah.
And he's the global vice chairman of
it. I've called it a disaster, and I think it's going to hit sooner than what they're saying. I'm saying in the 2021 to 2022 time frame, there's going to be 200 battery electric models that hit the market, that go into the showrooms. That's globally. Here in the U.S., it's over 120. And, when you look at the fact that electric cars account for 0.6 or 0.7% of sales right now, I just don't see the public embracing electrics nearly to the extent that these cars are going to be available in production.
Certainly not in North America. I think, the Chinese market is a little bit different. You've got some different factors that are pushing consumers in that direction, and then also in Europe as well. There's a lot of markets where, governments are looking, they want to ban sales of traditional
SUVs. I agree. It'll be better in China and better in Europe, but all you're saying is it'll be less of a disaster.
All right. So they're
less of a disaster in those markets.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
They're predicting by 2030, full EVs will be 20% of the U.S. market, 30% of the European market, and 35% of the Chinese market.
I think
by 2030,
pure battery electric.
Pure battery electric.
I think that sounds ambitious to me. 20% in the U.S. by 2030. At this snapshot in time, I don't buy that. I think it'll be less than that. China, not so much, to Sam's point. The Chinese have decided we're going electric, and they will make it happen. And the government will eat the cost of subsidizing that. And you're not going to see European or U.S. governments eating that kind of cost.
I think one thing that'll impact that adoption, particularly here in North America, is how much consumers are willing to adopt automated mobility, because those are going to be electrified vehicles. And, I think if we're relying just on individual consumers to buy EVs, then I think that 20% threshold for the U.S. market in 2030 is probably way too high. But I think if you're talking fleets, it's a totally different story.
I'm with you on that. Yep.
Yeah. So it all depends on how that plays out.
Yeah.
So the percentage will not be that difficult to achieve.
I agree with Sam. I think we're going to see mobility services explode. I think that as the cost comes down, when you get to autonomy, given geographic regions where you have the density of those services, people are going to say, I don't need a car anymore. I can save a couple of grand a year by getting rid of my car.
So speaking of autonomy, so they surveyed consumers, and consumers are willing to pay $2,300 more for autonomy. And they point out that the current industry costs are about $22,900 for autonomy.
That's the current. The cost is going to come down really fast. But it's very interesting that they came up with that number, because I interviewed the head of Audi's autonomous efforts, I want to say about 4 years ago. It might have been five. He was at MBS up at Traverse City. And Audi's target was $2,500. That's what they wanted. That's what they thought their buyers would pay at retail.
So this would be on top of the price of the car.
Correct. Right.
So a $2,500 option, which isn't really bad when you look at Mondoni's and you see what these people are charging for, you know, paint.
Well, you know,
I mean, you know, a year ago, you know, we bought a car. We paid $1,000 to get an ADAS package of adaptive cruise control, lane keeping system, you know, and a few other options. That was $1,000 just for that.
Right.
So if you're talking about a system that's capable of, you know, eyes off, hands off, brain off driving on the highway, you know, $2,500. It's not that bad. And I mean, you look at, I think the percentage of Tesla buyers that, you know, that pony up the $5,000 for autopilot, which is not nearly that capable, is apparently pretty high. And, you know, quite a few more beyond that are paying another $3,000 for full self-driving capability that, you know, we'll see if that.
Going back to Volvo with their level four system coming in a couple of years only, they said it would be a four-digit number. And so I asked him, well,
premium on top.
And I said, well, what do you mean? Is it 2000? Is it 4000? Is it 7000? They said a four digit number.
9999.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's probably closer to 10 grand. But that's half of what Alex Partners is saying what it costs today.
But you know what's interesting about all this stuff that these guys found, and you sort of touched on this a little bit about the you know, potential disaster, and they're basically saying that there are going to be some winners and there are going to be some big, big losers.
Lots of big losers.
And I mean, and so we're talking about car companies and supplier companies alike.
Right.
And it could really change the landscape in this industry in a way
very quickly. This is why you have Mary Barra saying that the industry is going to change more in the next 5 years than it did in the last 50. Mm-hmm.
Well,
this is exactly
today,
what she's referring to.
This morning they announced that, you know, they've got a little bit of a management shuffle at the top, where Dan Amen is still going to be president of GM, but he's going to be focused more on the cruise business than on the main GM business, the traditional GM business. And Mark Royce is taking over responsibility for all global product planning in addition to his product development duties.
I hadn't heard that, and I'm glad you raised that point, but it makes all the sense in the world. When you look at cruise right now today, on paper at least, has a value of $11 billion. They haven't even opened the store yet, and it's worth $11 billion. The growth potential is enormous. And I could easily see Cruise grow to be bigger than the traditional General Motors in the next decade.
And for those at home, that's Cruise Automation, not the Cruise vehicle. But just
thanks for that.
To be clear, people are going, man, right, Cruise, I've got one in my driveway. I can't imagine it's going to be.
There's the Chevy Cruise with a Z and the GM Cruise, which is a Bolt without a steering wheel.
Yeah, that's right. Right. What else you got on your list there, Gary?
Oh, we could go on all day and we'd want to do that.
Well, we're getting down to the end here. We should talk about the Ford train station, I think.
Right, so
because this ties into mobility.
So there's this 18-story building in downtown Detroit that has historically been used for, oh, I don't know,
vandalism,
movies showing the disrepair of the city, and it's a wonderful piece of architecture.
It's post-apocalyptic.
Apocalyptic, and it's what's called relic porn, where people go around, you know, to see these
relic
sites.
Porn, yeah.
And so Ford has purchased it and will be rehabilitating it and will be turning it into offices. And they made that announcement this week. And they previously bought another building, and this is in the Corktown area of Detroit, and that goes back to where the Irish came during the Great Potato Famine, and
including Henry Ford's
The Ford family is Irish family, and so Corktown, and so Bill Ford Jr. said, "You know what? Here's this big eyesore. We're going to turn it into a magnet. We're going to turn it into a magnet that we're going to draw young people who are going to say, this is cool." And I think it's cool. I think that this is the sort of thing that Silicon Valley can't offer Boston can't even offer, Philadelphia can't offer. And there it is. There's a picture of the building.
And yeah. what makes this particularly interesting is, you know, choosing the Corktown area. You know, there's a lot of still a lot of empty buildings there. There's also a lot of empty land, and it makes for an interesting palette for Ford to work with as a place to try out different ideas for mobility. I mean, they've already started in recent weeks running their Chariot service back and forth between the main Dearborn campus, 7 miles west on Michigan Avenue, and the factory. And they'll be expanding that. But I think over the next several years, as they get the building refurbished and get people moved in there, and as well as also taking over some other buildings, they're going to use that whole area as a place to try out a lot of different experiments for what kinds of services people are going to buy, what are they going to be willing to pay, what else can you do with these vehicles besides just moving people. And that's similar to what they're already starting to do in Miami. Is they're trying to figure out what is the viable business, because so far with around all of this technology, you know, whether it's something, you know, basic ride hailing like what Uber's doing or, you know, what GM's doing, nobody's actually figured out a way to make a profit on any of this. So everybody's figuring out what is the combination of business models and operational models and technology that we need to actually be profitable and have a sustainable business over the long term.
So, John, we got a question from somebody earlier in the week about this and was asking, is this Ford just deflecting attention away from what they're not up to?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it certainly does do that. You know, now Ford is getting all these accolades, whereas prior to the announcement of the train station, everybody is scratching their head going, what the hell's wrong with this company? But I don't think that's why they're doing it. I think at its heart, they need to recruit new young talent. And it's hard to get them to, you know, come to Michigan. It's harder to get them to go to Detroit. It's really hard to get them to go to a traditional old automaker. So you create this really cool place at the old train station. You can be part of a, you know, doing something positive. You can contribute to the revitalization of a once great city. And you can not have to go to Dearborn where, boy, it's hard to get out of that culture. You can create an entirely new culture with this separate building, the separate really campus that they're going to set up there, and throw all your latest and greatest stuff in there, all your electric stuff, electric car stuff, all your autonomous car, all your mobility services. I think this could trigger a new tech corridor in the Detroit area that starts in Detroit, goes out to Dearborn, and continues on out to Ann Arbor. And I think it's really exciting for this area, and I think it's good for Ford. And I think that's what they're looking at, is a much bigger picture than trying to create a PR scenario right now that's positive that could be gone in another week if something else goes wrong at the company.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they've actually already had some success, you know, along those lines with Argo AI. You know, I think part of the reason why they structured the Argo deal the way they did is it gives them an opportunity to, you know, they've got a controlling interest in a company that's a startup that is in a different place. It's not in Dearborn.
So this is the autonomous technology thing in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so Brian Selesky and his team there that are doing the production version of the software for Ford's coming autonomous vehicles. You know, being based in Pittsburgh, you know, working in a startup culture, you know, something that's separate from the rest of Ford. You know, they've had some good success, I think, in recruiting people to come there, to come to Argo, and I think, you know, this is kind of the next step. And, you know, at the event on Tuesday, you know, Bill Ford and Jim Hackett, the CEO, talked about, you know, how this whole campus area is not going to be just Ford. They're looking to bring other partner companies in and other businesses in that vicinity, much like over the last 20-30 years, when they refurbish an auto plant, a manufacturing plant, you know, they'll bring their suppliers in and they'll have a whole campus of factories around an assembly plant with all the suppliers doing their parts nearby and then, you know, delivering them just in time. You know, this is kind of a next generation of this. You've got a couple of thousand software engineers working in the train station, and then, you know, all these other companies around it that are feeding into it, whether it's sensor suppliers or, you know, doing other software or other elements of this mobility ecosystem.
You know, it's sort of interesting if you look at the architecture, the landscape of Detroit. that Henry Ford II was instrumental in the Renaissance Center, which is currently General Motors headquarters. Now you've got Bill Ford Jr. with the train station. And, I mean, here's a company that we all know is, you know, associated with Dearborn first and foremost, but their fingerprints are on the skyline in Detroit in a way that no other company.
But the approach with the train station is completely different from what Henry did with the Rensen, where, you know, that was conceived as a city within a city, and it was really kind of isolated from
the rest
of Detroit.
Right, but just to get to the point that when he did that, I mean, it was just like...
I mean, the goal was similar.
Unthinkable, right? Yeah. I mean, and similarly, we have Bill Ford Jr. doing what his uncle had done in his own way.
Yeah, no, I agree. And... look, Ford had zero presence in the city of Detroit, and that was an embarrassment to them because we saw the city go into bankruptcy. We've seen this amazing resurgence as it comes out of it. GM has played a major role in that. I mean, they're a great corporate citizen in the city. FCA's done a little bit of stuff, but Ford was noticeably absent. Well, Bill Ford Jr. fixed that this week, man, you know, to what you guys are saying. Ford's back in the city in a big way.
Yeah, back in the city where it was born, in Highland Park, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, look, we've talked about a whole bunch of things. Time to wrap up the show. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the show. Always good
pleasure
to have
to talk
you
to you guys.
Yeah, Gary, always good to do the show with you. And that Thermavant stuff, very interesting.
That
all
is.
The graphene
design.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Interesting
good.
Potential there.
And, of course, we want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.